Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Van Lanningham, and I'm an alcoholic. Due to the grace of God, actions in AA and sponsorship, my sobriety date is March 16th, 1992. Very happy to say that. This mic is kind of odd. I want to thank the committee for asking me here. I certainly appreciate it, and it's nice to be back up in my neck of the woods, if you will. I want to thank Don for leading the meeting. Don's my kind of alcoholic. He immediately proceeds to veer off of the format, and then after a couple minutes of that says, I'm going to try not to veer off the format, and I've always had kind of this shoot first, aim later mentality towards life that gets me into a lot of trouble, so I identify. And I hope I say something helpful in this talk that will curb that resentment. Don did say something, though. He said, I want to be where you're at. And I would concur that opinion. I certainly want to be where you're at, because this is the one thing that I have ever found that seems to work for what is wrong with me. I'm sometimes, I like to, you know, it's a funny thing about alcoholism. And I don't know what the breakout, if we have any Al-Anons here or whatnot, but I'm assuming most people here are in AA. And if you are, and if you have alcoholism, that means you have a disease that our book tells us is rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness, rooted in it. So think about that. We have a group of individuals here who, for the most part, are only concerned about themselves. And supposedly, we help each other, but only because I get a benefit from it. I'll help you to ensure immunity that I don't take that drink. And I'm not going to do it unless I'm getting something for it. I think that's kind of a shallow way to describe Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes, because I think that when we get together and when we are gathered, there seems to be this power, this spirit, that you can literally sometimes feel it in the air. And what is that? If we are selfish and self-centered by nature, if all we care about is ourselves, then why then, when we get together, do we feel this electricity in the air? I've come to believe, and I know that Bill Wilson used to talk about it, that alcoholics have a deep-seated belief to see and desire to see each other succeed. Not because I benefit in any way, shape, or form. I just want to see a fellow sufferer get out. I want to see a fellow sufferer find a way to pull themselves up and make it, because we understand each other as few do. We understand the hopelessness and the despair and the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that we've all been through. And we want to see each other succeed. And I think if you know where to look sometimes, you can start to see that ethic shine through in Alcoholics Anonymous. For example, I don't know if we have anyone here, but if we had anyone here who was celebrating a sobriety birthday, I can assure you that this place would erupt into applause. And the lower the birthday, the more enthusiastic the applause. Why? If somebody had a year, we go crazy, you know. And we're not clapping because I benefit in any way, shape, or form. It's because I'm genuinely happy to see someone get this thing. Why is it at my home group, and I would bet yours, that when someone gets up to read how it works or the traditions and they're stumbling and they're having a tough time, the applause are always a little louder for that person than someone who reads it flawlessly? Why? Because we appreciate the effort, because we all know how difficult it is to get up and do this thing sometimes. And I think the place where you can most see it is at sobriety countdowns. And I've been fortunate enough in the last few years, I tend to be sitting up here. This is a really high stage, by the way. I hope I don't fall. I could do serious injury to myself. But during sobriety countdowns, as we go down, 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 I like to watch the alcoholics in the room as they scan the room, because there's a glow about them and a look as we get down, you know, to 1 month and 3 weeks and 2 weeks. And geez, if we have somebody here with 1 day, we explode into a standing ovation. Why? Because we want to see each other succeed. And so I want to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous because this is the place I belong, and you are the people that I belong with. Now, I didn't know that, of course, my entire life. I didn't aspire to join Alcoholics Anonymous when I was younger. Being an alcoholic wasn't even on my list of anything to do. I have known for a long time, and I want to make this very clear, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that. I don't mean it was a theory. I don't mean I thought maybe I wasn't. I knew that I wasn't. And that deep-seated belief almost killed me. And the reason I knew I wasn't an alcoholic is that there's something else wrong with me. I have known that for a long time. I have had problems long before I ever drank. I have had an emptiness about me that I could never describe. I'm going to lose my name tag, so I'm just going to set it here for now. Apparently I grabbed the wrong one, so it's probably good I'm taking it off. anyway, I've had an emptiness about me and a loneliness about me, and sometimes I hear things, and I don't know if that's alcoholism, but was that a cowbell? I need more cowbell. I don't know what I'm saying. I've never felt right in my own skin, and I've never been able to articulate this to anybody. I've never been able to come up and say, can I explain to you what's wrong, and perhaps you could help me? Because I never knew. I just knew I felt funny. I just knew I felt goofy and odd. And it seems like people get this manual on how to live life, the basic principles every human being needs to be a human being, and I don't have that book, and I've never read it. And I spend a lot of time feeling like I'm standing on the outside of a bubble, and you're all in the bubble. And you at least, you know, you're in there, and I'm out here, and I can't figure out why. I spend a lot of time comparing the way I feel to the way you look, and I never seem to come up. Nobody ever looks like I feel, and so I am terminally different and terminally unique, and nobody has any of the problems that I have. I have a racy mind that just races uncontrollably and just analyzing everything and looking at everything and wondering what's going on. I'm wondering why people are knocking things over. I'm just all kinds of things. And, you know, it's just always going, and I can't seem to shut it off. I'm extremely sensitive by nature. Now, when I say that I am sensitive, I don't mean that somebody says, hey, Jeff, you're stupid. Oh, that hurts my feelings. I'm sensitive. At least that would make sense. I mean people saying things like, well, hello, Jeff, and how are you? Well, what the hell did and how are you mean exactly? What are you trying to imply? And, you know, I got to go sit down and analyze that. When I got into school, when I was in the first grade, there was 21 of us. I'm not going to chronologically go through every grade, by the way. I say that because there might be people in the audience like me. It's like, if this guy goes through every grade, I'm leaving at seventh. But in the first grade, there was 21 of us, and it seemed to me, and this isn't, of course, what happened, that everybody had paired up to be best friends. You and I will be best friends. You two be best friends. You two be best friends. And I kind of felt like the odd man out. Nobody was mean to me. Nobody did anything. They were pleasant and they were nice, but I hadn't connected with anyone like everyone else seemed to do. And, again, felt ill at ease and out of place and anxious. That's another thing. I was always anxious about things, except I didn't know what. I would get waves of guilt, and I would not know what I'd done yet. Like, I almost had this premonition. I'm sure I'm going to do something bad, so I'm already feeling bad about it. I don't know. And I set off, as I think most of us do, to fix what was wrong with me. I don't like feeling that way. I don't like the way that things look and the world feels. I want to change this. My attempts at changing thing involved me going out for a lot of different activities. I went out for sports. I was in football and basketball and track and wrestling. I went out for band. I went out for theater. Nothing seemed to fit. Nothing seemed to work. Nothing ever made me feel like, ah, this is it. This is what I've been missing. It made maybe for a little while, but I would always become restless and discontented with things very quickly and move on. And so that's kind of how I grew up. I don't want to paint you a childhood that was totally horrible or anything. It just seemed like overall things kept getting worse. Whatever this blackness was inside of me was continuing to grow and continuing to need a solution that I couldn't seem to find. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in kind of a pathetic home from a drinking perspective. My dad, I never saw him drink. He drank once when I don't know if I was even born. He was in Vietnam, and he blacked out, and he woke up the next morning, and he was scared that he blacked out and that he'd lost control, and so he swore off alcohol and has never drank again. What's that all about? You got to quitter, you know, you got to stick it out. And my mom would have one glass of wine on Christmas Eve, and she wouldn't finish that. When I became of age, I would finish it. And when I say of age, I mean like 10. And she gave that up my first stint through treatment. So I didn't have any examples. I didn't grow up even thinking about drinking. In fact, had you asked me back then, I would have said, no, I'm not going to drink. I want to be a good kid. You know, I want to do something with my life. I want to be a good person. And I'm going to join clubs that promote not drinking. And but anyway, so I had no example, if you will, of drinking. But when I was 15, I was introduced to alcohol for the first time. And what happened was we'd gone out. I used to say that we had gone out and we stole some alcohol. I call that now kind of podium fluff because I don't know that it was really we stole it. I mean, technically, yes. But what it was I went to my grandmother's house who kept a bunch of alcohol. They had some old bar downstairs stocked with all these old bottles. And I just said, hey, Grandma, I'm just running down to grab something. Don't worry about me. So I guess if that's your constitute stealing, but it wasn't as cool as I made it, like we'd done a heist with ski masks or anything. I ran down, grabbed a bottle of Canadian Windsor, and had an opportunity to drink alcohol. And alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my solution. Because every emotion, every situation that I've explained to you, alcohol has the ability to fix and change it for me. It is a magic elixir to me. It literally unshackles me, and it allows me to get into the game of life like I have never been able to get. I can do things I cannot do sober. My thinking clears up when I'm drinking. It gets crystal razor sharp, and I can see things, and I know things, and I'm going to share them with you. And I can't wait, because your life is going to be enriched, too. It's a beautiful thing happening here. And that first night, my first drinking experience, I drank way too much, way too fast, passed out for most of it, blacked out for most of it. But I had the night relayed to me in chunks, bits and pieces, and I'd done things. I'd picked fights with people. I'd asked girls out. I'd started crying at one point. I just had apparently lived the gamut of life and gotten out there. And I remember on Monday, people I didn't even know knew me were coming up to me and telling me what a wild man I had been and telling me how crazy I had been. And it felt good. It felt like I belonged. Second time I went out and drank, I took it a little slower, and I found the effect that alcohol has on a person like me. And I, for years, have struggled to try and find a better way to say this, but I really can't, so I'm just going to stick with what I know works, because this is my experience and this is my story. When I would go out, you have to remember how uncomfortable I am in my own skin sober. And so I would, by my nature, I would just stay at home. By this time, I'm 16, 17 years old. The world had become so painful, I didn't even want to go out anymore. I mean, it's tough to be in this world when a look can just devastate you. You ever said hello to somebody and they didn't say hello back happily enough? You know, like, hey, how are you doing? Oh, hey, Jeff, how are you? Oh, you know, that kind of stuff just kills me, and I don't want to be that guy, and I don't want to put myself in that kind of a position. So it would be easier for me just to stay home. But some friends of mine drug me out to some party, and I remember sitting there, and I'm thinking to myself, why am I here? You know, I don't know why I'm here. I mean, just nobody likes me here. I know that, and I'm an idiot. I just know that. I'm the only guy here in a long-sleeve shirt, and it's the middle of July. What the hell is the matter with me? Why would I do that? And then some guy would walk in, and I was always jealous and envious of guys because they had this camaraderie and bond that I could never seem to have. And I always see the cool high fives and cool nicknames for each other and stuff. And that guy would come in, and I would think, that guy's going to want to fight me. I just know it. I'm going to mouth off or do something stupid. And then she would come into the room. I've had a she in my life since I was 5 years old, and she is the girl that I am pursuing. And if I could just get her, everything would be different. Everything would be different. I know this to the core of my soul. If I could just get her. Now, when I say I am pursuing her, I in no way mean I'm taking any action whatsoever. But I'm staring at her a lot. And if she by chance looks my way, I quickly turn away. So dating's not a big part of my story. And then I start drinking, and somewhere along the lines, a magical transformation takes place. And the first thing that seems to happen is I stand up a little straighter, and I'm looking at the same room with the same people and the same things going on, but it all looks different to me. First thing I'm thinking to myself is, I am so glad I came here. I am making this party, you know, it'd be dead without me. I go up to this guy that had intimidated me an hour before, and I now am no longer, I'm not full of fear, I'm not inadequate, I'm not anything. I let him know that if he is looking for trouble, look no further than right here, baby. And I look in the mirror, and I'm like, yeah, I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt, that's kind of silly of me. I won't be needing that, and rip that off Hulk Hogan style, and wouldn't do that now, I'll tell you. And I go up to her, and I let her know that we are destined to be together. And she didn't seem to reciprocate my feelings, so I'm not in the least bit embarrassed or hurt by that. I lock her into the bathroom till the poor woman can come to her senses, you know. And that's how it is for me. Now, I seem to, when I start drinking, lose the ability of control. And what that means is that when an alcohol goes into my system, a drink starts taking a drink, and I just take off. And I didn't really ever have that much ambition to stop, but I do know that I seem to overshoot the mark a lot. When I go out drinking, I just want to get there. I just want to get comfortable and feel okay. And yet I was always getting so drunk. And the problem with that is if you drink like that long enough, you're going to start to develop consequences. And eventually, if you develop enough consequences, the faithful day will come where you make the firm declaration that you're not going to drink again. And that's where I discovered the second part of my illness, which is a mental obsession of the mind to drink alcohol. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor was taking me through the doctor's opinion. I remember saying, yeah, that doesn't apply to me. I didn't have a mental obsession of the mind. I didn't sit around shaking, needing to drink all the time. But he explained to me that's not what they mean. They mean I have a mind that will block out all ideas to the contrary as to why I should not take that first drink for the insane idea that it will be different this time. And you can fill in the blank on what that insane idea is. And I had a lot of them. I remember I was one of these people that I thought the more people I told I would quit drinking, the better my odds were. And that doesn't work, but it does make you look like a jackass later on when you start drinking. But I was always telling everybody, don't be offering me alcohol, I'm done. And one time we were on a road trip, and I don't know, we were like 6 miles out of town, I grabbed a beer. And my buddy, who's trying to be helpful, he's like, well, I thought you quit drinking. I was like, well, I did when I'm in town, but road trips are a whole different thing, you know. And that made perfect sense, made sense to him, too. It only has to make sense long enough to get that first drink into my mouth. When that happens, a reaction takes place that seems to crave more. I end up drunk, and I wake up the next day remorseful with a firm resolution not to let that happen again. And I was caught on that cycle, and I could not get off. I fell prey to the fallacy that if I change my environment, everything will be different. And I went off to college. I was convinced, you know, mine it is my problem. You know, I've got this reputation I have to maintain. I got these bad-seated friends that are bringing me down. I'm going to college, and it's all going to change. I'm going to finally buckle down. I'm going to apply myself for the first time in my life. It's going to be beautiful, and I can't wait. And in fact, I'm going to just be married to the library. That's what I'm going to be a nerd. Because, see, back in 1989, people that spent a lot of time in the library and studied and worked hard, I called them nerds, okay? I don't call them nerds today. I call them boss and sir and things like that. But, boy, I was cool in 1989. Hey, boss, remember how cool I used to be? Anyway, I got down there and totally blew off. I mean, my whole freshman year was just a joke, and I mean, literally, I think I completed 4 credits. The old withdrawal was my best friend. And so I got down for my second year now. It's all different. It's all going to be better. And I remember I'd made the most sincere pledge that I personally believe I'd ever made, that I was going to quit drinking. And God, I believed it. It was the first week of school. I was sitting at my desk, and some friends of mine came by, peer pressured me into drinking. Well, you tell me if you could withstand peer pressure like this. They came by and said, hey, Jeff, we're going drinking. You want to go? Wait for me. And off I went. Our book says we don't have an effective mental defense against the first drink. I don't even have a mental hesitation. I just go. And I went off. Nothing new. Got way drunker than I planned to. Everything was same old, same old. She walked into the room again. And I remember I just was feeling so good. And I thought, you know, I'm going in. And I went over to her, and I just started telling her about destiny and the fact that, you know, we were destined to be together and blah, blah, blah. And I remember telling her, I'm like, you know, I've been following you around. And they call that stalking? I call it love. And I had this thought pop into my head that life's too short. And as I've said, you can bet your butt that when an alcoholic has the phrase life's too short go through their head, a big life-changing decision is about to take place. And I decided I didn't even want to ask this girl out. I'm just going to propose, you know. And so I asked her to marry me. And then I remember telling her, no, don't answer yet. I want you to know who I am. And I'm not a weirdo. And so I started telling her my story, the long, unedited version, and I'm going on and on about how I think about suicide all the time, but I won't do it now. And I don't know, you know, what's not to love there? Anyway, she let me babble on for a while, and finally she looks up at me and she says, you know, look, you scare me and I want you to leave. And I was just devastated by that. And I decided in a kind of a grandiose theatrical fashion that I would leave. And I remember telling her, you want me to leave? Fine. I'm going home to kill myself. And I think somehow I'm making a point there, although I've yet to discover what the point is I'm making. And so I told her I was going home to kill myself. Went home, grabbed a bottle of sleeping pills, took a handful, and was in a strange sadistic way kind of proud of myself. I just made this big scene and told everyone I was going to kill myself. And by God, I've actually done it. So at least I'm going out doing what I said I was going to do. That counts for something. A friend of mine showed up, and I, you know, told him what I had done. And he's like, God, we got to get you to a hospital because you have to talk to a priest or your soul can't be admitted to heaven. And I was so drunk that made sense. I'm like, oh, let's go. And I'll drive. And so I drove myself to the hospital. And got there, nurse came down, I handed her the bottle, she took it, she started laughing, and I remember thinking, I'm drunk, I know that, I'm really drunk, but laughing seems a little unprofessional to me. And she held up the bottle, she's like, well, Jeff, what you took were vitamin C tablets, and it didn't dawn on me that I wasn't going to die. And she said, well, now by state law, we have to keep you here. And I said, I'll go peacefully, but I want my own room. And she said, you'll get your own room all right. And boy, did I. It was a beautiful room with padded walls and curtains on the Velcro and a bed that was bolted down and eye slits in the door. And I was in the psych ward. Kind of a weenie way to end up in the psych ward if you think about it. You know. What are you here for? Well, my dog was telling me to kill the mailman. Ah, I took too many vitamin C. I'm going to share this. Should I share the other suicide attempt? No? Well, they say yes, Will. I got to thank Will, by the way. Will and I are on the end of an 800-mile trek. We were down in Iowa last night at a convention, and we've had a great time. We've gotten a chance to talk. By the way, in Iowa, I want to tell you what they're doing down there. I don't know if this is violating the traditions or not, but I think it's cool. They had Bill Wilson read How It Works. They flashed his image up here, and they had a recording of Bill reading How It Works. This is the craziest thing I've ever seen. I was just mesmerized by the whole thing. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. Suicide. I was always thinking about suicide. I'm not making light of alcoholic suicide attempts, by the way. I had a lady a couple weeks ago accuse me of that. In no way I'm making light of my alcoholic suicide attempts because they were so ridiculous. But I got it into my head. I was thinking to myself, it's like, well, I want to die. I know that. And I started going through my head of all the different things that I could do. And I decided that, obviously, I can't overdose. I've botched that. I can't cut my wrist because I can't stand the sight of blood. I don't want to hang myself because I understand that, you know, you lose control of your bodily functions. And I don't want that to be the last image of me. I want people to think highly of me when I'm dead. And I'd read that freezing to death was a beautiful way to die. It's painless, and angels come and just take you away. And I thought, that's for me. So one night drunk, on a bitterly cold night, I went back to my dorm room. It was like 20 below, and I opened the window and shut the heat off in my room. And then I sat down in my chair, and I thought, okay. And after a little while, I'm like, whew, it's getting cold. They didn't mention that in the book. So I turned the heat up just to take the edge off a little and ease in. Still, I was kind of cold. I'm like, well, boy, my bank key looks nice, so I think I'm going to go curl up in that. And what will happen is this room will slowly get colder and colder. I'll be asleep, and I'll be dead by morning. And, yeah, that didn't happen. I woke up. My room was freezing, I can tell you that. And I had a terrible cold. Could have used some vitamin C. But anyway. But the bottom line for me is that, and I say these things in all earnestness, I mean, they're humorous now, but they weren't humorous then. I mean, I genuinely didn't know any other way to cope with life other than to try and check out. And what happened for me was I'd been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gone to a meeting, and I was convinced I don't need this kind of help. If I want to quit drinking, I just got to put my mind to it, and I'll be fine. And for the next 2 years, I struggled with my own willpower to try and quit drinking, and never could. My last drunk, on a Thursday night, I'd managed to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was very proud of myself. I really was, because it was a hard thing for me to do. A lot of times, I would drive by with the intent of going, and then something just wouldn't let me stop the car, and I'd take off again. And then, of course, I'd wait till 8:01 and think, well, the meeting started. I can't go now. And anyway, but I'd gone to a meeting. I was very proud of myself, and I came home that night. And my roommates, it was a Thursday night. They weren't doing anything special. They had some friends over. And I panicked. I panicked like I've never panicked before. And I remember thinking, I can't function in life without alcohol. I can't talk to these girls. I can't talk to these guys. I have to have it. My friends weren't even looking to party that night. And I started pushing the idea. Let's go drinking. Let's get some alcohol. Let's go drinking. No, Jeff, let's just hang out. Let's just be cool tonight. No, I'll buy. And I was absolutely stripped away of any remaining ideas as to who I was. I saw myself for exactly what I was. And I was a person who was completely dependent upon alcohol to function. And I got drunk that night, and I got drunk Friday, and I got drunk Saturday. And I woke up somewhere, I'd drunk into the night on Sunday morning, and I woke up on that Sunday, which was March 15th of 1992, with this terrible sense of dread that if I ever drink again, I'm going to die. I've never experienced anything like it, and it scared me to death. And like any good alcoholic man, when I am faced with that kind of fear, I do what we do. And I called my mom, because in the end of the day, I am a mama's boy. And I called her. She was very calm and collected, which was unlike her. Because I didn't sugarcoat it. I said, Mom, I think I'm going to die. If I ever drink again, I think I'm going to die. And it scares me because I don't know if I can't not drink. She got me some help. She got me into treatment. Treatment got me back into Alcoholics Anonymous. By this time, I was 21. And convinced I was the youngest person in the history of the world to sober up, and I started going to meetings. Now, let me tell you what I did not do in the early days. I did not have a home group. I did not have a commitment in a home group. I did not have any regularity to my meeting attendance. I went when I felt like it. I was given the philosophy that you can take what you want and leave the rest, and I invoked that liberally. But the problem is if I knew what I needed, if I knew what I needed, then the chances are I would have already done what I needed to do to get better. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have any kind of an unemotional point of view in my life, and I certainly had no relationship whatsoever with anything resembling a higher power. Nothing. I attended meetings. I took up space. I judged people. I was negative. I was cynical. And I was on the fast track right back out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm a guy, as I said at the beginning, that alcoholism, or I've been convinced that alcoholism is not my problem. And even in AA, it seemed to me that that was not my problem. At 6 months sober of not drinking, I was convinced more than ever that alcohol is not, I am not drinking now. I am 6 months sober, and I left my house with the idea of killing myself. Once again, that's always an option on the table for me. Drinking or trying AA one last time. And by the grace of God, I ended up at Alcoholics Anonymous one last time. And a lady gave me some advice that saved my life. And she said that I needed to find a home group and get involved in it. And I needed to get a sponsor. And I needed to quit worrying about not drinking the rest of my life and just try not drinking for today. And luckily for me, I went and I started. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get a sponsor. And I went and I asked somebody and they said no. And I asked another guy and he said no. And God was bringing me to the person I needed to be with. He brought me to a guy who I would have never asked to be my sponsor, and I certainly would have never listened to him. He brought me to this guy who was all fired up on Alcoholics Anonymous, bad. And I found out later that he had just moved to Minot, and his sponsor had said, I want you to find some new people, preferably sick ones, and start working with them. And I qualified big time. And so his eyes lit up, and I sat down with him that night, and I made a deal with the devil. He said to me that I'm going to ask you to do some things, and I'm going to ask you to participate in your recovery. And if you think you can handle that, then, yeah, I'd be happy to sponsor you. And I had nowhere else to go. Ultimately, for me, I tend to make the right decision when I have no other decisions to make. Because if a bad one's in the mix, that tends to be the way I lean. But I didn't have any other decisions to make. I didn't have anywhere else to go. And I told him that Yeah, I will try it your way. First thing he said, we're going to meet once a week. And of that on that meeting time, I got 15 minutes to whine about whatever it was I wanted to go on about. And believe me, I used all 15 of that. And then the last 45 were going to be spent going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because apparently someone had hidden the instructions on how to work our steps in there. Who knew that? He said that I had to get involved in his home group and that I had to get a job in it, or a commitment, as he called it. And I remember he would make me go early. Our meeting started at 8 o'clock, and he would have me there at 6:30. I was like, God, you know, this is ungodly early. Now, I don't know how your mind works, but if you go early, you get to leave early, right? Yeah, let me tell you, that wasn't flying with him at all. I was staying late. So he's got me involved in this meeting. He's got me on cleanup committee. I'm cleaning up messes I didn't even make. And I found out drunks are very inconsiderate of the cleanup guy, let me tell you. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous now. And I'm meeting him. And I would meet him. We'd sit down, have a cup of coffee, and he'd say, well, tell me about your week. Boy, will I ever. I got on the bus, and people were looking at me funny, and I walked into class, and two girls were laughing, and I know they were laughing at me, and da-da-da-da-da. And he'd let me go on and on for a little while, and then he'd say, okay, well, let's, you know, read the book. And so slowly but surely, I started to incorporate some basic principles of recovery. And I started to learn a little bit about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me through those things, and all along the way, it seemed to me he was kind of tricking me into taking actions that I wouldn't have taken had he told me up front. I remember one night he said, we're going to go speak at the hospital on Saturday. You want to go? I'm like, yeah, I suppose. He's like, well, I'll pick you up at 5:30. You know, the meeting's at 8. That's really early, but I suppose we're going to stand there like idiots and greet for 2.5 hours. So, okay. So I'd get in the car, and we'd start driving out of town. And I'd be like, aren't we speaking at the hospital? And he's like, yeah, we are, but it's in Bismarck, 100 miles away, and boom, off we go. And I had nowhere to go. I was trapped in the back middle hump, I might add. And I've made the observation, I don't know if it's true everywhere, but anytime you find a sponsor that's sponsoring three or more people, inevitably someone will grasp onto the role of what I like to call the good one, okay? The good sponsee is sincere about recovery. They're giving it their all, and, you know, they're just doing the deal. And people like me who are cynical and judgmental and more preoccupied with being cool can't stand people like that. And Chris was the good one of the bunch. And Chris whips out as Bill sees it now. It's a Saturday night. We're going to the I don't know where we were going, some hospital in Bismarck. And he says, hey, I got a great idea. Let's play this game I made up. I'll read as Bill sees it a passage, and then we'll guess what it's from. Is it from the big book, the grapevine, the 12 and 12, a letter? It'll be great. And my sponsor is just lapping this up, right? He's, God, Chris, that's a beautiful idea. And I am in the back thinking to myself, no. I am not spending a Saturday night in the back of this car in the middle on the hump playing the what the hell did Bill write this in game. No. It's not going to happen. Of course, my other option was they could pull over and let me out on the side of the road. And so the nice thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it doesn't care what I think. It cares what I do. And I was in the car, and I was taking the right action, and I was around the right people. And so despite myself, truly despite myself, I started to get better. When I became a year sober, my sponsor started pushing me. By this time, he had really hammered into me this concept of selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my problem. And he had really employed in me this ethic of I need to be working with others. And I remember saying, there's no way. I can't work with others because I will screw them up more than they are already screwed up. Trust me, I don't have anything to offer. Nothing. I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to be able to answer any questions. Half the time, I don't even have the right motive on top of my mind. I mean, trust me, I would be doing newcomers a better service to stay away from them. And this was the mentality I had. And I remember him explaining to me, you know, you don't have to have anything to give. Other than this, you're going to spend two things in your life. You're going to spend money and you're going to spend time. And money will always be replaceable. So if you are willing just to give of your time, you are now doing exactly what you were supposed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is it. In whatever manner that I could. Sometimes it was giving a ride. Sometimes it was shaking somebody's hand. Sometimes it was asking a few simple questions and feigning interest in someone else's life. That is how my whole career of working with others started, was just trying to give of my time a little bit. Answer your phone, regardless of how inconvenient it is or the fact that you're taking an ill-deserved nap, you know, things like that. And I slowly but surely kind of, you know, caught on to that and started doing that. And so I didn't learn everything I needed to learn in that first year. I didn't learn everything I needed to learn about the 12 steps. I didn't learn everything I needed to learn about God or the traditions or the concepts. But I learned enough to stay sober. I learned enough to try and practice these principles in all of my affairs. And I learned enough to keep learning, if that makes sense. When I got to be 2 years sober, I was starting to get a little better. And I met another her. And her and I got hired at the same company on the same day. That's a sign. I went home and I told my sponsor, I said, I've met the one. And he said, well, Jeff, you know, it's not a good idea to date people you work with. And I said, no problem. Went down and quit my job. And you got to be specific. And we started this horrendous relationship. Let me tell you about Heidi and I. I didn't even realize this till I heard her talk last spring. I'm like, oh, that's true. We'd been dating for 3 months, and we started going to marriage counseling. We weren't even engaged yet, but we decided we were fighting so much that our relationship had become so sick in 3 months that we had to start going to marriage counseling. How many couples at 3 months are going to do that? You know, most normal, logical thinking people would be like, well, this clearly isn't working out. Good luck with everything. But no, not me and Heidi. We're going to stick it out. And so we're going to marriage counseling, trying to learn how to get somebody identifying. All right, it'll be okay. It's got a happy ending. So, but it's a long road. The problem with relationships, one of the things I learned when I did my inventory is just how bad fear is rampant in my life. And one of the worst fears I can think of, it's not often talked about, or maybe I don't often hear it, is this fear of abandonment. The fear that someday the whole world is going to wake up and come to the realization, you know what, Jeff? You're not what we thought you were, and we would be better off without you. And just someday I'm going to be left all alone. And that is compounded a million times over when I am in a relationship. It is so difficult for me to believe that she wants to be with me, that I only really require one thing to get past that. I need you to treat me special every day for the rest of our lives. And I don't think that's too much to ask in return. Let me tell you what I'm bringing to the table. I'll be very inconsiderate, very selfish, very manipulative. I will use fear at any point in time to get my own way. It's a good deal. And here's kind of a synopsis of me in a relationship. I'm really good at making it known that I'm upset with something. So I'd be sitting there, and Heidi would walk into the room, you know, and I'd be like, you know, and this is my wife, by the way, today celebrated 3 years in Al-Anon, and I am so grateful for that. In some respects, now that she's in Al-Anon, that kind of stuff doesn't work. If I try and do that now, you know, like, you know, she'd be like, God and I will be over here when you're done. It's kind of harsh. Keep the glove on if you're going to hit that low. But she didn't have Al-Anon back then, and so she'd always take the bait. So she'd be like, well, what's the matter, Jeff? Well, when you walked into the room, you know, you didn't tell me you loved me. And, I'm sorry, Jeff, I love you. Well, now what's the matter? Well, that didn't sound very sincere. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I love you. You know, well, now what? Well, I had to tell you to sound sincere. Now it's disingenuous. And, you know, just on and on and on. And that's what I was bringing to the relationship. 2 years sober and a two-year-old mentality. And but we somehow made it through that. I continued to do Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability and moved A back ahead at the leader of the pack of my life where it's supposed to be. And we got through that, and eventually came the day where I decided to propose and we got married. And we had a big A wedding. It was great. Most of the people in it were in A. The flower girl is now in A. I blame myself. And so we're married, and life is grand, and I'm 5 years sober, and I finally got out of college. I went to college for 7 years, and I'm not a doctor, let me tell you that. And now I got a college degree and I got a job and everything's getting better and I'm getting, you know, and I'm doing okay. I decide that we want to have a baby and, taking all the actions necessary and, we can't happen. It's not happening. We cannot get pregnant. And to make things worse, by this time I'm sponsoring like 10 guys and every guy I sponsor seems to be having an unwanted child out of wedlock. You know, they're calling up, oh, she's pregnant. It's like the injustice of it all, you know, and, we can't. And, but eventually one day, we took a test and we found out she was pregnant and we welcomed the birth of our little son, whose name is, middle name is Wilson after Bill Wilson, which I thought was fitting. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I can be a father. You know, I'm so unstable and I'm so emotional and I'm so immature and can I do it? And I've come to the conclusion, yes, I can do it. I can do it like I've done and been taught to do everything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to do it one day at a time. After that little son was born, we had a little girl. And I want to tell you something. I've been a bad just about everything you can be. I really have. I've been a bad husband. I've been a bad AA member. I've been a bad employee. But I don't know that I've ever been a bad father. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to say that because one of the things I learned quickly, one of the few things in this world I seem to grasp right away is kind of how to be with my children. The first idea that I really smashed quickly was these are not my children. These are God's kids, and I've been entrusted with them. So quit treating them like I own them. You know, spend time with my children. And in many respects, I've learned to be a parent by being a sponsor. I do the very same things I do with sponsees. I try and be a good example. I try and listen. I try and explain things. I try and give advice when I can. And things go well. I really have a tremendous relationship with my kids. My son, he's in the third grade now. But when he finished first grade, at the end of school year, we were cleaning out his classroom, and Heidi and I were over there. And his teacher called us over, and she said, do you mind if I have a word with you? We're like, sure. And she said, Mark has this pen that he's insisted on using all year long. He's never written with anything else. He always had to have this pen, and I just wanted to show it to you and make sure everything is okay. And I'm thinking, well, what pen would this be, and why would the teacher be calling me in? And it was a Cornhusker Roundup pen that said, Sobriety, the Great Life. And my son knows and understands the importance of Alcoholics Anonymous in this family. He does. He knows it because I've explained it to him. So that I'm giving you both sides of the coin, I should also explain this. Last night, or what day is it, Saturday? Thursday night before I was leaving, I was explaining to him that I was going to be gone this weekend. I was going to some AA conventions, and I was going to be speaking. And Mark said to me, really, Dad? Do they know when you talk it seems like 100 years? And no. That's my relationship with my family, and we were blessed to welcome our third child almost a year ago today. So yeah, we have these three little babies at home, and it's just wonderful. I continued to do Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's funny, after I got sober and grasped a certain amount of concept of what the steps are and so on and so forth, I thought, this is great. You know, AA is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And somewhere along the lines, I got it into my head, I'm just going to kind of put it on cruise control and just head on down the road. Everything's going to be fine now. I mean, I've learned some valuable lessons. But let me talk about my relationship with God, which was non-existent when I came into AA. I mean, non-existent. I didn't even know the words to the Lord's Prayer when I sobered up. I was very embarrassed about that. You know, the most common prayer in the world, and I didn't know the words. And so my higher power for a long time was my sponsor. My sponsor's voice was louder than my head. Sometimes people get all offended when I say that. I'm sorry. That's just what it was for me. And then it evolved into AA as a whole. I believed AA as a whole was a power greater than myself. And then somewhere along the lines, as I continued to go, it started to develop this relationship with God. And once that started, my journey has been to enhance that and work on that. Like anything, like any relationship. My marriage today with my wife, we've been married for 12 years. I don't have the same relationship with her that I do when we first married. It's grown and things have changed and we've worked through things and my relationship with God is no different. So I got it into my head, you know, I think I can put it on cruise control. And somewhere I readopted the philosophy that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. Except now I mean if I manage well in AA. So if I'm doing enough great things on the outside, I'm going to feel fine on the inside. If I have a cool enough job with a cool enough car, I make the right amount of money, everything looks good, I'm sponsoring all these people, I'm speaking at all these conventions, everything should be fine. Except the problem is I have an illness that will not allow that to take place. I have an illness that has to be treated spiritually, mentally, and physically, and it has to be treated by my actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's taken me a while to learn that lesson. It has taken me a long time to come to the conclusion and finally really understand what my purpose is here and what I'm supposed to be doing. And I can tell you this, one of my purposes here is to get up every day and be teachable, not have the answer, not speak to millions and save them. It's to be teachable and to continue to be learning new things because I don't have all the answers. And I need Alcoholics Anonymous now more than I ever did. And it's nice to be in that position. I'm going to tell you about my career. Sometimes people don't talk about it, but I think it's part of my story, and I want you to know. I'm a vice president today of a company, and I want to tell you how I became a vice president of a company. Last year, I was a marketing manager for a company, and I really was impressed with myself with how slick I was. And the job had become very, very important to me, and I hung on to it with a tightness that just doesn't belong in my life. And what happens for me is that when things start to move ahead of my recovery, I'm going to lose them. Last year, literally almost to the day, I was met in a parking lot by two guys who were basically telling me that I was no longer needed to be at that facility. And I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I had no idea it was coming, and I certainly had no idea why this had taken place. And I left, and I did what I've always been trained to do. Before I was out of the parking lot, I was on the phone with my sponsor, and he gave me some instructions, and I followed them. But for the next 48 hours, more and more poison would start to creep into my life. More and more poison of the idea. I've been active in AA. I have done a lot of things. I've sponsored a lot of guys. I have always said yes to AA requests. I have tried to work these steps. And at 15 years sobriety, this is what happens to me. I lose my job. 10 days later, by the way, we would welcome the birth of our daughter. So this is a stressful situation. And I was not happy about it. And I sat in my house and I got more and more bitter. And I thought to myself, I don't know that I'm going to make it back from this. I don't know that I want to. And then a series of events started to take place that just kind of led into something. And people started calling and people started stopping by. My friend Will stopped by and he brought me a little gift card for a movie rental and a 12-pack of Diet Pepsi, which a week earlier I would have dismissed as stupid. Ah, thanks, Will. You're a nice little emotionalism gift. Wasn't stupid that night. He was giving me the dignity so that I could have a little date night with my wife, even though we didn't have the money to do it at the time. And that night I found myself in my sunroom after 48 hours of all this poison creeping in, and suddenly I started crying uncontrollably, and I didn't know why. And I wasn't sad. And I thought, I've finally lost my mind. I've snapped and lost my mind. But that is not what happened at all. What happened was that every direction I looked at in my life looked beautiful. Every direction I looked at. And I came to this realization, I am not about my job. I am not about how much money I have in the bank. I'm not about any of those things. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the most important thing in my life, period. Everything else comes after that. I made the understanding that day, and I heard a speaker say this, and it's true for me, that I'm not ever going to be alone again, that I have friends. And if I have friends and I have a relationship with God, then I don't have to have fear. If I don't have to have fear, I don't have to have resentment anymore. And if I don't have resentment, I don't have to have hate anymore. And if I don't have hate anymore, I can finally experience what it is God wants me to experience all along, which is love. And I can finally start to at least work towards that ideal. And so I, from that moment on, made some very serious decisions and changes in my life as far as the actions I was taking and the philosophies and outlooks that I had upon life. And it's been a work in progress. I by no means have all the answers today. I will assure you, though, that I look at my job in a much different manner. I don't go in Mr. Hot Stuff. I go in with the ability to try and be of service because that's why I'm there. And that's why I'm at the company I'm at. The company I'm at, by the way, is run by a gentleman in AA, if you're wondering how I ascended the corporate ladder so quickly. We used to joke. I used to say, God, Scott, I'd love to come work for you, but I couldn't afford the pay cut. And God saw fit to do for me what I could not do for myself. And that morning I went over to his office and I said, I can afford the pay cut now, thanks. And he's been wonderful. And my life has been wonderful. And I'm very happy to be here. I really am. I've been taught a lot of great things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been taught wonderful things. I wanted to talk earlier, but I skipped over it about, you know, one of my big battles has always been, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? And unfortunately, even though I know the answer to that, I still have to debate it half the time in my head. I think I'd like to be right this time. I think I'd like to alienate everyone in my life and isolate myself from them, but I'll be right. I've had to get past that kind of thinking. And I've had to learn, a whole host of things that have come to me. And that's what I do. I get up and I pray to a God that I know today much better than I used to, and I hope I know him better tomorrow. And things slowly but surely seem to start to get better. And I'm very, very appreciative of that and very, very grateful of that. I want to close with this. This little baby that we have, when she was a couple months old, one night she was crying, and I went in to pick her up, and she was kind of squirming and trying to get away from me. Sound familiar? And I remember thinking to myself, Ella, just calm down. Just relax. I'm going to give you everything that you need. Everything that you need. I'm going to change you. I'm going to clean you. I'm going to feed you. If you're cold, I'm going to make sure you have enough blankets. I will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. That's what I'm thinking. Now, I realize that's a little deep for her to understand when she's 2 months old, but I was just thinking this to myself in my head. And I was suddenly struck with the realization, in a minute, we'll close this meeting with a prayer that begins, Our Father. And I was hit with the realization that night, standing there holding that little baby, doesn't it stand to reason that God is looking at me in the same way? Doesn't it stand to reason that we have a God in our life who's looking at us sometimes saying, just relax. I'm going to give you everything that you need. Just relax. And I'll tell you something. I have come to believe in that. I have come to find that to be true. And it is the most important thing that I have in my life today. I am so grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I was drinking, I took actions that I'm not worthy to be here. And when I've been sober, I've taken actions that would deem I'm not worthy to be here. But this is a program about second, third, and 100th chances. So if you're new, if you've been here a little while and you're trying to find your spot in life and where you fit, if recovery just isn't working out the way that you want it to, grab somebody next to you. We all have the same spirit inside of us of wanting to be helpful to each other. It's sometimes marred by calamity and defects of character, but we have it. And this is the best, safest, most hopeful place that I can ever be. And I want to thank you so much for asking me to be with you. God bless.